woman in a merciless and inflexible system. A lack of priors and a history of general good conduct didn't matter at all. Federal mandatory minimums dictated sentences. And if you were pleading guilty, the vast majority of us did, the only person with real leeway in determining what kind of time you would do was your prosecutor, not your judge. Consequently, there were sad-looking parents visiting their kids, though not mine. My mother was like a ray of sunshine in that room. For our visits every week, my mother was always dressed immaculately in soft, cheerful colors, with her blonde hair carefully styled, her makeup perfectly applied, wearing a piece of jewelry that I had given her for a distant Christmas or birthday. We would talk for hours about my brother, her students, my uncles and aunts, the family dog. I would fill her in on whatever new electrician's skill I'd learned that week. She always seemed perfectly comfortable in the visiting room, and every time she visited, I got comments from other prisoners afterward. "Your mama is so nice. You're a lucky girl." Or, "That's your mother? Get out. I thought it was your sister." I had been hearing that one most of my adult life. People would often say it to her as well. And even though she had received that compliment approximately 3,000 times before, it always made her glow. In the past, this familiar exchange made me feel resentful. Do I look like I'm in my late 40s or 50s? But now, I enjoyed watching her pleasure when people drew a close comparison between us. Even with this disaster I had dragged us all into, she was still proud to be my mother. It occurred to me that I had never seen my mother defeated, even when life presented difficulties and disappointments. I hoped that our resemblance extended beyond our blue eyes. My father, more than 1,000 miles away, was able to come visit me when the academic year was over. His relief when he saw me was palpable. I have always been a daddy's girl, and I could tell how it pained him to see his baby, even a baby in her 30s, in a place like this. We still enjoyed our time, eating peanut M&Ms while I spun all the intrigues of the place out for him to absorb. The difference between our weekly phone calls and an actual in-person conversation was like a text message versus a weekend-long visit. If there was a silver lining to this whole mess, it was the reminder of my family's greatness. I had a lovely visit with my mother that Mother's Day, although the visiting room was deranged. I had never seen it so crowded with large family groups. A lot of women in Danbury had families who lacked the resources to come and visit often, even though many of them lived in New York City. Tired grandmas and aunties, taking care of their daughters' or sisters' children during their prison stays, had a very hard time marshaling toddlers and teenagers on the buses, trains, and taxis necessary to get to Danbury. The trip could take 4 hours each way from the city and cost money. But Mother's Day was special, and children of every age swarmed the place, and a cacophony of conversations flowed in many languages and accents. In the midst of it all was my mother, smiling happily when she spotted me walking into the madness. 2 copies of The New Yorker arrived for me at mail call, to my horror. Someone out there had sent me a second subscription. Miss Esposito from C-Dorm also got the magazine and had been mad at me when my first copy showed up in March. She thought it was a waste of money for both of us to get it. The damn things were piling up all over the prison. Esposito was an odd duck. A big, solid woman in her 50s, she wore her dark hair in a disconcertingly girlish Dutch boy bob. She was always part of the welcome wagon for any new prisoner, regardless of race. She herself was Italian-American. She volunteered that she had been a gang leader with the Latin Kings, a claim I was at first skeptical about. Why would the Latin Kings have an Italian queen? But it turned out to be true. She was a former 1960s radical intellectual who'd gotten involved with gang activity at a pretty high regional level. Esposito was doing a long, long sentence. I could tell pretty quickly that Esposito, although a needy person, wasn't after anything from me that I wasn't willing to give, and she was heartwarmingly appreciative of my magazines and books. One day, she came to me with a fan in her hand. It was a medium-sized oscillating plastic table fan, like you might buy in Woolworths. It looked just like the one Natalie had. "Bunky, you going to be glad we got this when summer comes," she said. "You can't get these no more. They stopped selling them at the commissary." The commissary now sold a much smaller fan, a crappy little one that cost $21.80. The old school ones were prized, especially by the older ladies, who seemed to feel the heat most acutely. Esposito's fan was broken. It wasn't even hot out yet, but she was stressed. "Can you maybe take a look at this, down in the electric shop? I'll do anything to get it fixed." "No promises, but sure," was my reply. I toted the thing down to work on the bus the next morning and took it apart, with my co-workers observing keenly. It turned out to be an easy fix, and I was glad that my access to tools was helpful to another prisoner. Back in the camp, when I triumphantly plugged the fan in and it whirred to life, Esposito almost fainted with joy. I refused to take any commissary payment, but Esposito paid me in reputation. Almost immediately, another old-timer approached me, hoping for a board to slide under the mattress to help ease her back pain. There were a handful of older ladies doing very long sentences. Pop, Esposito, Mrs. Jones. And if I did one of them a favor, they were sure to tell everyone. Soon I was besieged by women bearing broken radios and broken fans and seeking repair for things in their cubicles, hooks for their clothing, loose conduits, busted shoe racks, all sorts of things. Little Janet thought this was over the line. "That stuff's not our job, Piper. It's not electric, so why should we fix it?" "No one else is going to do it, babe. The feds aren't going to take care of us in this shithole. We have to do for each other." She could accept that logic. And besides, she had other things on her mind at the moment. Little Janet had attracted an admirer, a tiny little white girl named Amy with a loud mouth. Amy was new among the always present subset of prisoners I called M&M-lets, Caucasian girls from the wrong side of the tracks with big mouths and big attitudes, who weren't taking shit from anyone except the men in their lives. They had thinly plucked eyebrows, cornrowed hair, hip-hop vocabularies, and baby daddies, and they thought Paris Hilton was the ne plus ultra of feminine beauty. Amy was the tiniest and the most obnoxious of the new crop of M&M-lets, and she was smitten with little Janet, who, despite her 2-year tenure in prison, seemed to have no idea how to handle a middle school crush. Little Janet did not mess with girls, so Amy was barking up the wrong tree. Little Janet wasn't so mean that she'd ice Amy. She tolerated her puppyish worship. When Amy got assigned to the electric shop, though, Janet had to lay down the law. If Amy didn't stop writing her mash notes and acting like a lovelorn cow, little Janet would stop talking to her. Amy seemed dejected, but resigned. My read on the situation was that Amy was not, in fact, a lesbian, and that this was basically a schoolgirl crush. I took one for the team, taking pity on Janet by taking Amy away with me on some of the housekeeping errands. I would not deny a fix-it request, even from someone I didn't like. We must have hung 100 extra cubicle hooks, which we would make out of C-clamps with a hammer, Amy spluttering and cursing the entire time. Despite her foul little mouth and frequent tantrums, I found within myself a surprising reserve of patience for Amy and adopted a mild but firm approach. She was kind of like a sweet tart, sugary but also puckeringly sour. No one else was showing her any positive attention. Amy reacted with undying allegiance to me, loudly alternating between calling me her mom and her wife, both of which caused me to snort with mock outrage. "Amy, I am not old enough to be your mother, and as for the other, you're not my type." Being helpful did make us more popular, and I got a lot more smiles and nods around the camp, which made me a little less shy. After almost 4 months in prison, I was still cautious, super cautious, and kept most people at arm's length. Many times I fielded the sly question, "What is the all-American girl doing in a place like this?" Everyone assumed I was doing time on a financial crime. But actually, I was like the vast majority of the women there, a nonviolent drug offender. I did not make a secret of it, as I knew I had lots of company. In the federal system alone, a fraction of the U.S. prison population, there were over 90,000 prisoners locked up for drug offenses, compared with about 40,000 for violent crimes. A federal prisoner costs at least $30,000 a year to incarcerate, and females actually cost more. Most of the women in the camp were poor, poorly educated, and came from neighborhoods where the mainstream economy was barely present and the narcotics trade provided the most opportunities for employment. Their typical offenses were for things like low-level dealing, allowing their apartments to be used for drug activity, serving as couriers, and passing messages, all for low wages. Small involvement in the drug trade could land you in prison for many years, especially if you had a lousy court-appointed lawyer. Even if you had a great legal aid lawyer, he or she was guaranteed to have a staggering caseload and limited resources for your defense. It was hard for me to believe that the nature of our crimes was what accounted for my 15-month sentence versus some of my neighbors' much lengthier ones. I had a fantastic private attorney and a country club suit to go with my blonde bob. Compared to the drug offenders, the white-collar criminals had often demonstrated a lot more avarice, though their crimes were rarely glamorous. Bank fraud, insurance fraud, credit card scams, check kiting. One raspy-voiced 50-ish blonde was in for stock fraud. She liked to keep me up to speed on her children's misadventures in boarding school. A former investment banker had embezzled money to support her gambling habit. And marriage-minded Rose Marie was doing 54 months for internet auction fraud. I gleaned this information about people's crimes either because they'd volunteered it or because another prisoner told me. Some people would discuss their offense matter-of-factly, like Esposito or Rose Marie. Others would never utter a word. I still had absolutely no idea why Natalie had been sentenced to 8 years in this snake pit. We got along well, and some evenings would spend companionable time together in our cube. I would sit on my bunk, reading or writing letters, while Natalie listened to her radio below. She would announce, "Bunky, I'm going to get in my bed, listen to my music, and relax." Every Sunday, we cleaned the cube together. We would use her irreplaceable plastic basin filled with warm water and laundry soap. She cleaned the floor with one of her special rags taken from the kitchen, while I did the walls and the ceiling with maxi pads from the box that sat in the bathroom, getting all the dust and grime off of the slanting metal I-beams and the sprinkler system that ran over my bed. Then we would fix my bed together. No one who has been down a long time will let the junior bunkie make the bed, as I had been schooled on my first day. I grew powerfully attached to Natalie in just a short time. She was very kind to me, and I could tell that being her bunkie conferred on me an odd credibility among other prisoners. But despite, or because of the fact, that we lived in the closest of quarters, I knew virtually nothing about her, just that she was from Jamaica and that she had 2 children, a daughter and a young son. That was really it. When I asked Natalie whether she had started her time down the hill in the FCI, she just shook her head. "No, Bunky. Back in the day, things were a little different. I went down there for a little while, and it was nothing nice." That was all I was going to get. It was clear that where Natalie was concerned, personal subjects were off limits, and I had to respect that. But in a world of women confined to such close quarters, juicy stories and secrets had a way of leaking out, either because the prisoner in question had at some point taken a blabberer into her confidence, or because the staff had done the blabbing, Of course, staff is not supposed to discuss personal information with other prisoners, but it happened all the time. Certain stories had a lot of currency. Francesca LaRue, a vicious and crazy Jesus freak in B-dorm, had been disfigured by extreme plastic surgery. A bizarre sight with balloon-like breasts, duck lips, and even ass implants, she was rumored to have performed illegitimate backroom cosmetic surgery procedures and to have injected people with transmission fluid to dissolve cellulite. I suspected the truth was plain old medical fraud. A clever and manipulative middle-aged blonde was rumored to have stolen tens of millions of dollars in an elaborate fraud scheme. One elderly lady had barely got her walker through the door before it spread like wildfire that she had embezzled big money from her synagogue. Most viewed this with disapproval. You can't steal from a church. Any story you heard from another prisoner had to be taken with about a pound of salt. Think about it. Put this many women in a confined space. Give them little to do and a lot of time. What else can you expect? Still, true or not, gossip helped pass the time. Pop had the best gossip, the most historical and revealing. It was from her that I found out why Natalie had been sent down to the FCI all those years ago. She had thrown scalding water on another prisoner in the kitchen. I was incredulous. Bitch was fucking with her, and what you don't know, Piper, is your bunkie's got a temper. It was very difficult to reconcile that kind of rage and aggression with my quiet, dignified bunkie, who treated me so kindly. In Pop's words, though, Natalie's no joke. Seeing how puzzled and disturbed I was by this new facet of Natalie, Pop tried to illuminate some prison realities for me. Look, Piper, things are pretty calm around here now, but that's not always the way. Sometimes shit jumps off, and down the hill, forget about it. Some of those bitches are animals. Plus, you've got lifers down there. You've got your little year to do, and I know it seems hard to you. But when you're doing serious time or life, things look different. You can't put up with shit from anyone because this is your life. And if you ever take it from anyone, then you're always going to have problems. There was this woman down the hill I used to know. Little woman, very quiet, kept to herself, didn't bother nobody. This woman was doing life. She did her work. She walked the track down there. She went to bed early. That's it. Then some young girl shows up down there. This girl was trouble. She starts in with this little woman. She's giving her shit. She's hassling her all the time. She's a fucking stupid kid. Well, that little woman, who never said boo to no one, put two locks in a sock, and she let that girl know what time it was. I never seen anything like it. This girl was a mess, blood everywhere. She was fucked up good. But you know what, Piper? That's where we are. And we're not all in the same boat. So just remember that. When Pop told me a story like this one, I would hang on every word. I had no way of verifying whether it was gospel truth or not. Like most things I heard in prison, but I understood that these stories held their own accuracy. They described our world as it was and as we experienced it. Their lessons always proved invaluable and inviolable. Mercifully, the closest I got to fighting did not involve a SLOC, the formal name for a weapon made out of a combination lock inside a tube sock, but rather roughage. Whenever something other than cauliflower and iceberg lettuce appeared on the salad bar, I went to town. One day, there was a bunch of spinach mixed in with the iceberg, and I happily began to select dark green leaves for my dinner. I hummed a little melody under my breath, trying to tune out the din of the dining hall. But as I carefully plucked the spinach, avoiding the lettuce, words began to emerge out of the noise near my ear.
Hey, 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 you! Stop picking! Stop picking in that!
I turned around to see where the shouting was coming from and at whom it was directed. To my surprise, a beefy young girl in a hairnet was glaring at me. I looked around, then gestured with the salad tongs. Are you talking to me?
Hell yeah! You can't be picking out the greens like that. Just fill up your plate and keep moving.
I looked at my salad bar adversary, wondering who the fuck she thought she was. I vaguely recognized her as New, a reputed troublemaker up in the rooms. Just the other day, Annette, who was still stuck up there, had been complaining about the disrespectful mouth on this 18-year-old kid. I knew from Pop that the salad bar was among the least desirable kitchen jobs because so much washing and chopping was involved in the prep. So it was usually done by the low woman on the culinary totem pole. I was furious that she had had the nerve to step to me. By now, I felt like I was pretty firmly established in the camp's social ecology. I didn't mess with other people, I was friendly but respectful, and hence, other people treated me with respect. So to have some kid giving me shit in the dining hall was enraging. Not only that, but she was breaking a cardinal rule among prisoners. Don't you tell me what to do. You have 8 numbers after your name just like me. To get into a public battle with a black woman was a profoundly loaded situation. But it didn't even occur to me to back down from this punk kid. I opened my mouth, mad enough to spit, and said loudly, "I don't eat iceberg lettuce."
"Really?"
I asked myself. "That's what you're going to throw down with?"
"I don't care what you eat, just don't be picking in there."
Suddenly, I realized that things had quieted down quite a bit in the dining hall and that this unusual conflict was being watched. All clashes between prisoners were sporting events, but for me to be in the mix was freakish. I was transported back to my middle school's parking lot when Tanya Kateras had called me out, and I knew that the only choice was to fight or prove to every person in school that I was chicken shit. In suburban Massachusetts, I went with chicken shit. Here, that just wasn't an option. But before I could even draw breath to assert myself with big mouth and raise the stakes, Jay, my friend from work in B-dorm, materialized at my side. Her normally smiling face was stern. I looked at her. She looked at Big Mouth, not saying a word. And just like that, Big Mouth turned and slunk away.
"You okay, Piper?"
said Jay.
"I am totally okay, Jay,"
I replied hotly, glaring after Big Mouth. Disappointed, everyone turned back to their food, and the volume went right back up to its usual level. I knew that Jay had just saved me many months of trouble. Now that I had my headset radio, I couldn't believe how much easier it was to carve some enjoyment out of the day. With a pair of white sneakers purchased from commissary, I began jogging around the track every evening. I could tune out the pandemonium of B-dorm at will, and go much farther around the quarter-mile track now that I had music in my ear. Rosemarie tipped me off to WXCI 91.7, the radio station of Western Connecticut State University. I had forgotten about the pleasures of college radio, the exquisite randomness of what got played, the 20-minute between songs banter of 19-year-olds, the smack of music I'd never heard against my brain cavity. I was in heaven as I went around and around that track, giggling at sophomoric radio skits about Dick Cheney and listening to the new bands like the Kings of Leon that I'd been reading about in my copies of Spin but had never actually heard in the endless repeat of classic rock versus hip-hop versus Spanish radio that is the soundtrack of daily life in prison. Best of all was a recurring weekly show, 90s Mixtape, which compiled the best songs from every year of the 1990s, 1 year every week. The 1991 Top 10 included Pavement, NWA, Naughty by Nature, Teenage Fan Club, Blur, Metallica, Nirvana, and LL Cool J. Those songs made me think of Larry and of the trouble-seeking girl I had been when they were first released. Running around the track, I relived every song I had heard in the background when I was running around the globe, a careless and ignorant young girl, launching myself into trouble so deep that it put me on this prison gravel 11 years later. No matter how stupid, how pointless, how painful my current situation was, As I listened to Mixtape every week, I couldn't deny the love I still felt for that reckless, audacious fool who was still me, if only in my mind. May 17th was Larry's and my anniversary. The wretched fact that we were separated and it was all my fault was impossible to deny. But when I found the right Hallmark greeting in the free collection handed out via the chapel, I felt a tiny bit better. "This is you, baby. Such a fine black man, who knows who he is and knows where he stands, who doesn't have time to play any games, who's earned my respect and gives back the same, who gives of himself to build up trust and commits his heart to big dreams for us, who can heat me up and then love me down, and within his arms all my joy is found. And on the inside, this is you, baby, such a fine black man. This is me loving you, hard as I can." Joking aside, the sentiment was all true. I spent an evening in my bunk composing what I would write on the card. It was our 8th anniversary of dating. I told him how quickly that time had passed, a quarter of our lives spent together. How all the risky choices we had taken together were the right ones, and how I couldn't wait to come home to him, the only man for me. I promised to keep counting sunrises until I could be where he was, anywhere that might be. One day, when we got to work, DeSimon stepped out of his office and locked the door. "Today we're going to practice with the lift," he announced. What the hell did that mean? The lift turned out to be a mechanical hydraulic lift. I tried to figure out what it might be used for. All of the buildings were pretty low-lying, and the FCI itself was only a few stories tall. DeSimon shed some light on my question. There were a handful of area lights around the grounds that were hundreds of feet high. The lift was used when a bulb or fixture on one of them needed attention. "Oh, hell no," said Jay, who was trying to get transferred to the warehouse. "No motherfucking way are you getting me up on that." The rest of the crew were in agreement with her. But we still had to go through the elaborate process of setting up the lift properly. Essentially, a metal platform a few square feet with a railing that went straight up in the sky when you pressed a button. If you screwed up one of the safety measures, it was easy to imagine the splat on concrete. When we had finally done it properly, DeSimon said, "Who wants a ride?" A few intrepids, Amy, little Janet, Levy, climbed onto the platform and pushed the button, each stopping long before the lift reached its full height, then coming down.
"Scary.
I want to try." I climbed onto the platform, and DeSimon handed me the control button. Up, up, up. My heart beat hard as I left the concrete behind, the faces of 6 women and a beard upturned to watch me. Higher, higher. I could see everywhere, for miles farther than I had imagined beyond the confines of the prison. Maybe I could see my future from up here. The entire platform was swaying in the breeze as I kept my finger on the button. I wanted to go all the way up, even though I was clutching the railing with white knuckles and the blood was pounding in my ears. At its highest extension, the lift stopped with a jerk, scaring me even more. A little half-cheer rose from my coworkers, who were shading their eyes to see me. Women were coming out of the other shops to have a look.
"She crazy," I heard someone say admiringly.
I peered over the railing that I was clinging to, grinning. Mr. DeSimon appeared to be trying to hide a smile in his beard.
"Come on down, Kerman. No one wants to clean you off the concrete."
I almost liked him that day. The place was emptying out. Early in the month, there was a rush of new faces, including a clique that had smuggled in marijuana via the Coochie Express. Squat and cough doesn't really seem to work. And brought a flurry of shakedowns into the entire camp. But then the flow of new prisoners seemed to stop abruptly. The prevailing rumor was that the BOP had closed the camp, accepting only prisoners who were already doing time in other facilities, because they didn't want Martha Stewart designated to Danbury.
Unclear was whether this was because the place was a broken-down dump or for some other more sinister reason. The moratorium on new prisoners seemed real, because the flow of new faces slowed to a feeble trickle. But people kept leaving to go home. I wished that I was leaving. The adrenaline of the initial "can I do this" period was definitely over, and the rest of my time in Danbury stretched ahead of me. Larry and I had spent much time and energy hoping to get my sentence down to a year, feeling like that would be a victory. Now I was in the midst of it, and the months felt like they would never end. Still, the novelties of prison socializing could distract me. Jay, like many of my favorite people, was a Taurus, a fact I learned when Big Boo Clemens approached me in B dorm to invite me to Jay's birthday party. Big Boo was a giant bull dyke. When I say giant, I mean at least 300 pounds. She had skin like a Dove ice cream bar and was the most attractive 300-pound woman I have ever seen. She used her massive bulk to intimidate, but her girth was less daunting than her wit. She had a lightning-sharp way with words. She was the resident rhyme master, and her charisma and charm were undeniable. Her girlfriend, Trina, at 200 pounds, was pretty but a bitch on wheels and was commonly referred to by other prisoners as pie face, but only behind her back. She loved to argue, was as disagreeable as Boo was smooth. Boo told me the day and time when the party would take place and that I could bring a cheesecake. "Where's the party?" I asked, and was surprised when she said, "Right here in B dorm." Prison parties were usually held in the common rooms. Otherwise, you risked being hassled by the guards. When Jay's birthday arrived, I wondered how she felt. This must have been her second or third birthday in prison, and she had 7 more stretching in front of her like hurdles on a very long track. I turned up for the party promptly after dinner, cheesecake in hand. It was the only prison cuisine I knew how to make. The party guests gathered in the middle corridor of B dorm outside Jay's cube, which she shared with her bunkie Sheena. B dorm residents made up most of the guests, and we pulled up the folding chairs and stools from our cubes. My neighbor, bipolar Colleen, was there, and so were Jay's buddy Bobby, the biker mama from back in the Brooklyn MCC, little Janet, Amy, and Lily Cabrales, who I had observed in action on my first morning in B dorm. Lily almost drove me insane when I first moved in, as she would call out across the room again and again, "Pookie, what you doing? Pookie, come over here. Pookie, do you got any noodle soups? I'm so hungry." Pookie was her very quiet special friend, who lived 2 cubicles over from me. I would sit on my bunk and ask myself, and sometimes Natalie, will she ever shut up? Lily was a loud-ass Bronx Puerto Rican gay for the stay, don't fuck with me piece of work. But a funny thing happened, especially after Pookie went home and Lily quieted down a bit. She began to grow on me. I guess maybe I grew on her, too, until we got to the point where she nicknamed me Dolphin after my tattoo, and I could get a big smile out of her with a little joke. Delicious, the cheerful titty admirer, was there. She played spades with Jay. Delicious might have been my old friend Candace's doppelganger. This may seem surprising, as Candace is a North Carolinian white Dartmouth grad who is a high-powered technology PR maven on the West Coast, mother of one and a clown enthusiast, whereas Delicious is a black DC native with a 5 o'clock shadow, a bunch of tattoos, and unusually long nails, who worked as a prison dishwasher while sharpening her excellent singing voice and off-the-cuff witticisms. But they had similar hair, similar stature, the identical button nose, and the same mellow with a touch of hyper way of looking at the world. It gave me goosebumps. Delicious sang all the time. All the time. She would rather sing than speak. As soon as I got to B dorm, she asked me, "Y'all got any gangsta books?" When I told her about my friend Candace on the outside and how they were like twins, Delicious looked at me as if I were the weirdest person she had ever met. For the party, Boo had prepared a game for us to play.
She made up a rhyme that was a riddle about every invitee, and the game was to guess the identity of the riddle's subject. This was an irresistible novelty, and soon we were laughing at each other, although Boo had refrained from being really mean at anyone's expense. She lives right here, between you and me, and when you see her, you think of the sea. When Boo read that rhyme, I had to bite my lip to hide my smile while I looked around quickly. Most people looked confused, but a few were smirking, pleased with themselves for getting it right away. "Who is it?" asked Boo. A lot of shoulders were shrugging, which irked her. "It's Piper," shouted Sheena and Amy in triumphant unison.
"I don't get it," Trina pouted at her girlfriend. "That don't make no sense."
Boo was exasperated. "She lives right here between you and me. That means she lives in B dorm. And when you see her, you think of the sea. That's her tattoo. Get it? Sea, sea? The fish?"
"Oh, yeah," Lily Cabrales grinned. "That's my dolphin."
Chapter 10, Schooling the OG. I had learned a lot since arriving in prison 5 months ago. How to clean house using maxi pads. How to wire a light fixture. How to discern whether a duo were best friends or girlfriends. When to curse someone in Spanish. Knowing the difference between feeling it, good, and feeling some kind of way, bad. The fastest way to calculate someone's good time. How to spot a commissary hoe a mile away, and how to tell which guards were players and which guards were nothing nice. I even mastered a recipe from the prison's culinary canon, cheesecake. I made my first effort at cooking for someone's going-home party, preparing a prison cheesecake according to my co-worker Yvette's Spanish and hand gesture instructions. Unlike a lot of prison cookery, most of the necessary ingredients could be bought at the commissary. Prison cheesecake. 1. Prepare a crust of crushed graham crackers mixed with 4 pats of margarine stolen from the dining hall. Bake it in a Tupperware bowl for about a minute in the microwave and allow it to cool and harden. 2. Take 1 full round of Laughing Cow cheese, smash it with a fork, and mix with a cup of vanilla pudding until smooth. Gradually mix in 1 whole container of Cremora, even though it seems gross. Beat viciously until smooth. Add lemon juice from the squeeze bottle until the mixture starts to stiffen. Note, this will use most of the plastic lemon. 3. Pour into the bowl atop the crust, and put on ice in your bunkie's cleaning bucket to chill until ready to eat. It was a little squishy the first time. I should have used more lemon juice, but it was a great success. Yvette raised her eyebrows when she tasted it. "Buena," she proclaimed. I was very proud. Prison cuisine and survival techniques were all well and good, but it was time to learn something more productive. Pleasantly but persistently, Yoga Janet had been inviting me to join her class, and when I wrenched my back, she iced it while I lay prone on my bunk.
"You really should learn yoga with us," she gently chided me. "Running is too hard on the body."
I wasn't going to give up the track, but I started descending to the little gym for yoga class several times a week. Larry laughed when I told him. He had been trying to get me to try yoga at a fancy downtown studio for years, and he found it both entertaining and annoying that it had taken incarceration to get me into Downward Dog. The Fieldhouse gym had a rubber floor. At first, we used undersized blue foam mats. But with great effort and persistence, Yoga Janet got proper orange yoga mats donated to the camp from the outside. Tall and calm and down to earth, Janet managed to create the sense that she was teaching us something important and valuable without taking herself too seriously. Camilla from B dorm was always there. Alongside all the many misfit toys at Danbury, Camilla was instantly noticeable. My friend Eric spotted her in the visiting room and declared her the hottest woman in prison in America. No offense to you, Pipes. She glowed with health and radiated beauty.
Tall, slim, with a glossy black mane, tawny brown skin, a pointed chin, and huge dark eyes, she was always laughing, loudly. I was drawn to her willingness to laugh, but that very quality was the subject of derision among some of the white women. Those Puerto Ricans, it's like they don't even know they're in jail. They're always laughing and dancing like idiots, sneered tall, mopey Sally, who wanted everyone to be as miserable as she was. And as ignorant, Camilla was Colombian, not Puerto Rican. Camilla was a natural at yoga, easily mastering warrior poses and back bends and giggling helplessly with me as we tried to balance on one leg while twisting the other around it. On the mat next to Camilla would be Gada. Gada was one of the handful of Muslim women I met in prison. It was difficult to guess her age. Her face was deeply creased. But she had an air of tremendous vitality. She might be in her 50s or 60s. Her hair was salt and pepper, and she hid it under makeshift headscarves, sometimes a pillowcase, sometimes a contraband cloth napkin. I never quite got the story straight, but it seemed that the guards frequently confiscated her headscarves. We were not allowed to wear do-rags when in uniform. Only commissary-purchased baseball caps or prison-issue wool knit caps that itched like hell. I thought surely there should be some exception for Muslim women. I could never figure out if I was mistaken and the hijab was forbidden in the prison system, or if Gada just couldn't get it together to obtain a prison-approved headscarf. She wasn't much for rules. Gada was from Lebanon, but had lived in South America for many years and so was fluent in Spanish, with pretty tenuous English. Because of her long residence in Latin America, Gada was an honorary Spanish mommy. This was a good thing because she was totally unaccepting of the authority of the staff and uninterested in the institution's rules, and only the monumental efforts of her friends to protect her from the consequences of that indifference kept her out of the SHU. This won her both annoyance and respect from her fellow prisoners. No one seemed to know what Gada was down for, but we could all agree that she was another OG. Gada loved Yoga Janet, which was the primary reason she came to class. She was not all that interested in doing the poses properly, but she brought great enthusiasm to the ritual. The final member of our ragtag band of aspiring yogis was Sister Platy, who took proper form very seriously. Sister had tight hips, so twists and pigeon pose prompted a knitted brow, and if she had indulged in the greasy home fries at the midday meal, the forward bends would give her trouble. When I sank into a deep lunge, the tiny nun would study me, plaintively wondering, "What am I doing wrong?" The five of us had a camaraderie that made those few hours among the most enjoyable of the week. Every class, we would meet to claim the peace that, at Danbury, could only be found within one's own body. Each session ended with Janet's final relaxation, when she spoke soothingly to us of the work we had just completed, and the things we had to be grateful for every day, together in prison. And every single week, Gada would fall asleep within minutes during final relaxation, snoring loudly until someone woke her. One evening, Miss Mahoney, the cheerful education administrator from down the hill, made a lot of people very happy. Miss Mahoney was one of the few prison staffers who seemed to be on our side. As near as I could tell, she was one of the education department's few saving graces. She did have an annoying habit of trying to be down on the mic when she was on the PA system. On this particular evening, she announced that a gender awareness class would be offered in the dining hall. What exactly was going to be conveyed there was unclear. Then she got to the important matters. Would the following ladies please report to the CEO's office for their GED test results? And you could just tell from her voice that the news was good for every name called. Malcolm, Mahoney called. I jumped out of my bunk. Natalie had taken the GED test approximately a dozen times and was definitely way past due to pass it. She got nervous during the testing, and time and again the math section had proved her bête noire. Where was Natalie? When I got to the main hall, there were already screams of joy, and women were pouring out of all the rooms and dorms. When a woman of 25, 35, 45 has struggled to earn her high school diploma in prison, taking pretest after pretest and trying to learn in a poorly run program and classes full of every imaginable delinquent student behavior, and then actually passes, it is a victory. Some of these women had dropped out of school 30 years before and were finally getting one of the only positive things, one of the only measures of achievement one can earn in prison. Plus, it meant that these women could finally earn above the lowest pay grade at their prison jobs. If you didn't have your GED, you couldn't earn over 14 cents an hour, which was barely enough to pay for toothpaste and soap. Everything came out of our prison accounts: hygiene items, phone calls, fines. If a prisoner didn't have her GED and didn't have money coming in from outside, she was screwed. Natalie had toiled for many years as a skilled baker in that prison kitchen, a treasured member of the cooking staff, and yet she could never be paid more than $5.60 a week for 40 hours of work. Where was Miss Natalie? Her name had been called 5 minutes ago, but I didn't see her in the throng of jubilant, shouting, laughing women in the hall. Where was my enigmatic bunkie, that supremely self-possessed woman? I knew how badly Natalie wanted that diploma. I suspected it hurt her that she had struggled for so long to pass that math section. With embarrassed dignity, she had declined my offers of study help. This was her moment. Could she possibly be hiding, ashamed to join the orgy of congratulations and illegal hugs taking place in the hallway? No, wait, she was down at the track. I had watched her putting on her sneakers. In my flip-flops, I took off down the hall, out the building, and down the stairs to the track at top speed. She didn't even know. Halfway down the stairs, I was calling out to the others on the track, "Is my bunkie down there?" I rounded the field house, and there she was with her crazy friend, Sheila. "Bunkie, your GED results are back," I panted. Natalie smiled nervously. "Come up, Bunkie. Come up and see." "Okay, Bunkie, I'm coming." Ladylike to the end, Natalie did not rush. I started up the stairs as a number of people came down. "Where's Natalie? Where's Miss Malcolm? There she is. Come on, Natalie." My bunkie looked surprised, but she still didn't hurry. She had that look of skepticism on her face, unwilling to give herself over to celebration until she saw its cause with her own eyes. When she entered the camp, an entourage traveling before and behind her, the noise in the hall was deafening, and people were calling out, "Where's Miss Malcolm?" She was immediately enveloped by people hugging and congratulating her. As she made slow progress up the hall, Natalie laughed and smiled and looked overwhelmed. Down near the CO's office, someone was waving her test results in the air. "Natalie, you did it!" I suddenly thought I was going to lose it and start crying right there, and I was not a crier. The release of so much collective happiness in that miserable place was almost too much for me. It was like hot and cold air colliding, creating a tornado right inside the hall. I took a deep breath, stepped back, and watched my bunkie be enveloped by well-wishers. When I congratulated her in the relative privacy of our cube, she tried to downplay her triumph. But I could tell that she was deeply satisfied. The fact that I'd become used to life in prison shocked my friends and family. But no one on the outside can really appreciate the galvanizing effect of all the regimented rituals, whether official or informal. It's the insidious, cruel paradox of lengthy sentences for women doing 7, 12, 20 years. The only way to survive was to accept prison as their universe. But how on earth would they survive in the outside world when released? Institutionalized was one of the greatest insults one could throw at another prisoner. But when you resisted the systems of control, you suffered swift retribution. Where you fit in and how comfortable you were willing to get depended on the length of your sentence, the amount of contact you had with the outside world, and the quality of your life on the outside. And if you resisted finding a place in prison society, you were desperately lonely and miserable. Mrs. Jones had been in the camp longer than any other prisoner, but would be going home next year. Her cubicle, a puppy program single in the corner of A dorm next to the outside door, was so cozy we all feared what would happen when it came time for her to leave it.
"I like this cube. I get all the fresh air I want, plus I can walk the puppies just like that," she cackled.
During the day, I liked to drop by Mrs. Jones' cube to play with Inky, the Labrador retriever she was training as a service dog. I would sit on the floor and rub Inky's belly while Mrs. Jones fussed around the cube, showing me photographs of women with whom she had done time, or her latest crochet project. She specialized in Christmas stockings. And asking me if I wanted random objects she had squirreled away during her 15 years in prison. Mrs. Jones spent a lot of time down on the track walking Inky, and she was impressed by my running. She was concerned that she was overweight, so she resolved to start running too.
"You and me, we're going to compete," she would crow, poking my shoulder hard. "We'll see what you're made of."
But Mrs. Jones was perilously top-heavy, and after wheezing her way around only one lap, she sat on a bench, heaving for breath. I suggested she try speed walking instead. This she found manageable and would huff and puff around all morning at top speed, obsessively. One day, Mrs. Jones came to see me in my cube. I was writing letters up in my bunk. She peeked around the particle board like a little girl, which I found disconcerting.
"What's up, Mrs. Jones?
Are you busy?"
"Not too busy for you, OG. Come on in."
She came closer to the bunk bed and whispered conspiratorially,
"I got a favor to ask you."
"Shoot."
"You know I'm in the college class, right?"
The class was a basic business course, taught by a pair of professors who came in from a nearby accredited college. It didn't mean much in terms of getting one closer to a college degree. For that, you needed to pay for correspondence courses. But it did count toward program credit with an inmate's case manager. The case managers were tasked with managing the completion of our sentences, which meant recalculating our good time. We were supposed to serve only 85% of our sentences if we earned good time. Collecting fines from our inmate accounts. If you couldn't pay fines, you wouldn't get good time. And assigning our program activity, including mandatory reentry classes. The programs available to campers were feeble and few. The college class was one of the only options. But after reading over and helping to revise a number of women's homework assignments, I was skeptical about the class's usefulness. Camilla's business plan for a Victoria's Secret competitor, for example, was entertaining but highly hypothetical and totally unrelated to what she might be doing when she got out of this human warehouse in 5 years.
"How's it going, Mrs. Jones?"
She explained that it was not going so well. She had received a bad grade on her business plan. The OG was worried.
"I need a tutor. Will you help me? We have a paper due on a movie we saw. I'll pay you."
"Mrs. Jones, you will not pay me anything." "Of course I'll help you. Bring me your stuff and let's look at it together." When I agreed to help the OG, I had in mind a typical student-tutor relationship. I would talk to her about her assignments, ask thought-provoking questions, and review and correct her work. She came back with her notebook and papers and a book that she put on my bed, Managing in the Next Society by Peter Drucker.
"What's this?"
"Our textbook. You gotta read it."
"No, Mrs. Jones, you have to read it."
She looked at me, anguished and pleading.
"It gives me a headache."
I remembered that in addition to being nutty from having been locked up for well over a decade, Mrs. Jones was reputed to have had a few screws knocked loose by her abusive husband. I frowned.
"Let's take a look at your paper that's due. The one about the movie."
This provoked another anguished look.
"You need to write it. I can't do it," They didn't like my last paper, she said, pulling out her business plan, embarrassed. She had received a poor grade in big red pen. I flipped through it. Mrs. Jones's handwriting was hard to read, but I realized that even if her penmanship had been flawless, the contents of the paper made little sense. I had a sinking feeling in my stomach. I might be a convicted felon, but as the daughter of teachers, I had a strong aversion to cheating on tests. Mrs. Jones, I shouldn't write your papers for you. And how am I going to write a paper about a movie I didn't see?
I took notes.
She thrust them at me triumphantly. Oh, great. It appeared that the movie had had something to do with the Industrial Revolution. Was it better to let Mrs. Jones fail on her own or to help her cheat? I knew I was not going to let her fail. Oh, gee, why don't I ask you questions about the movie and I'll help you do an outline, and then you can try writing the paper. Mrs. Jones shook her head stubbornly. Piper, look at my business plan. I can't write it. If you won't help me, Joni and A. Dorm said she would do it, but you're smarter than her. Joan Lombardi was hardly a rocket scientist, and I knew she would charge Mrs. Jones for her tutoring. Plus, my ego was involved. I sighed. Let me see your notes. After extracting a few context-free specifics about the movie from her, I set to work writing an incredibly generic 3-page paper about the Industrial Revolution. When I was finished, I walked the neatly handwritten paper over to the OG's cube in A dorm. She was ecstatic. Mrs. Jones, you are going to recopy this paper so it's in your handwriting, right?
Nah, they'll never notice.
I wondered what would happen to me if her instructors caught this. I didn't think I'd be sent to the SHU or get expelled from prison. Mrs. Jones, I want you to at least read the paper so you know what it's about. Do you promise me?
I swear, Piper, on my honor.
Mrs. Jones was beside herself when she got her paper back in class.
An A? We got an A!
She glowed with pride. We got an A on the next film summary as well, and she was jubilant. I couldn't believe that her teachers had no comment or questions about the difference between these papers and her previous one, right down to the different handwriting. Now she grew serious.
We gotta write the final paper. This is 50% of the grade, Piper.
What's the assignment, OG?
It needs to be a paper on innovation, and it has to be based on the textbook, and it has to be longer.
I moaned. I desperately wanted to avoid reading the Peter Drucker book. I had spent my entire educational and professional career avoiding these types of business books, and now they'd caught up to me in prison. I didn't see any way around reading it if the OG were to pass her class.
Innovation is a little broad, Mrs. Jones. Any ideas on a more specific topic?
She looked at me helplessly. Okay, how about fuel-efficient cars, I suggested. Mrs. Jones had been locked up since the mid-1980s. I tried to explain to her what a hybrid car was.
Sounds good, she said.
Larry was perplexed when I asked him to put in the mail some basic web articles on hybrids. I tried to explain about the OG's term paper. He was totally swamped, having just started a new job as an editor at Men's Journal. Part of his job negotiations had included securing permission to work a half day every Thursday or Friday so that he could visit his girl in prison. I tried to imagine what exactly that conversation had been like. The lengths he went to for me were amazing. Soon, I got a packet of information at mail call and started to slog through Managing in the Next Society. Among the last prisoners to show up in May, before the camp was closed to deflect Martha Stewart to another facility, there were 3 new political prisoners, pacifists like Sister Platy. They had been arrested and sent to prison for protesting at the School of the Americas, the U.S. Army Training Center for Latin American Military Personnel, read Secret Police, Torturers, and Thugs, located in Georgia. These special newbies were pretty much central casting leftists,
earnest pale faces who were willing and eager to sacrifice for their cause, and to discuss it ad nauseam. One of them looked like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, all watery blue eyes, bad posture, and Adam's apple, and she seemed irritated by her situation. The other was like a young novice in a convent, with shorn hair and a perpetually surprised expression. Then there was Alice, about 5 feet tall with the thickest Coke bottle glasses I had seen in a long time. She was as friendly as the dogs in the puppy program, and as garrulous as her partners were withdrawn. Sometimes they would all join us for yoga class. These three made a beeline for Sister Platy and followed her around like ducklings. I thought it was cool that Sister had a posse of pacifists in prison. Yes, the government wasted millions of taxpayer dollars prosecuting and locking up nonviolent protesters. But here on the inside, the political prisoners now had a community of like-minded folks. Sister certainly enjoyed their company, discussing theories and tactical strategy for bringing the military-industrial complex to its knees for hours on end in the dining hall. Alice and her co-defendants